Hey folks, Micah here. We're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. My guest today is David Pierce, who's a philosopher, a founder of the World Transhumanist Association, which is now called Humanity Plus, and the author of The Hedonistic Imperative. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. Yeah, you've written so much that so many things that are kind of really groundbreaking in this area that I am I'm kind of floored. In a sense, you have one of the most ambitious transhumanist projects of all, I would say. And I think it's quite remarkable. So for people who aren't familiar with it, to explain what the hedonistic imperative is and the abolitionist project. What does that mean?
Back in 1995, I wrote this online manifesto. Essentially, the hedonistic imperative argues that we should use biotechnology to phase out suffering, not just in humans, but also non-human animals. And the abolitionist project is, if you like, the negative side of this. I think our overriding ethical priority is to minimize and then abolish suffering. But once we've done that, I would very much hope that we will ratchet up our hedonic range. And if today's hedonic range is, let's say, between minus 10 to 0 to plus 10, there is no genetic or biological reason I'm aware of why we can't create a post-human civilization of between, let's say, plus 70 or plus 80 and plus 100. I.e. life based on gradients of intelligent bliss. The gradients, I think, is really important because uniform bliss, like uniform misery, is a recipe for loss of critical insight, social responsibility, any kind of intellectual progress. Mm-hmm. But so long as information-sensitive gradients of well-being are conserved, you're not asking people to give up their existing values and preferences, for example. I mean, if you're a Christian or a Buddhist or a secular ethicist, radically ratcheting up hedonic set points doesn't involve buying into anyone else's preferences or version of utopia, except, that is, unless you have deep and principled aversion to ratcheting up hedonic set points.
Yeah, so, okay, so there's a lot there, and I want to unpack that in terms of that the gradient and all that. But this has been called the naturalization of heaven. You're essentially talking about creating engineering paradise, something like that, right? Creating heaven on earth.
Yes, of course, it sounds fanciful, but yes, there's a lot of the image, if you like, of heaven and paradise is drawn, and I was born and raised in a Christian culture from Christianity. Yes, as I said, one doesn't need to buy into a particular spiritual or theological conception. Of course, this is optional.
Yeah, so it's interesting because you're specifically you're specifically tapping into this idea, not just that we make human life incredible and wonderful, which is a fairly typical transhumanist project, but also that we make the life of all the species wonderful. And one of the images on the, I think, abolitionist project that comes up a lot is like the lion with the lamb, which is this biblical image of
absolutely
the...
yes, yeah.
And so that's really remarkable. That's I don't know that I've heard anyone else propose that as an actual engineering project.
Well, yes, as I said, the Bible is shall we say, light to the technical specifics, but there is no kind of biblical injunction against tweaking our genetic source code. And if the lion and the lamb really are going to lie down together with the wolf and so on, they are both going to need a bit of tweaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the reason I cite these ancient sources, and of course it's not just Christianity, it's Buddhism and the tradition of the Indian subcontinent, is to highlight that getting rid of suffering is not just some crazy transhumanist idea, mm-hmm. and that what is different today is biotechnology. But if we are ethically serious about getting rid of suffering, i.e. if it really is, you know, not just fancy words one uses, but a serious ethical enterprise, some hard-headed decisions have to be taken as to existing Darwinian life forms. I mean, some people, for example, will say that a lion that isn't out asphyxiating gazelles isn't truly a lion. Mm. But one might equally say that humans who take to wearing clothes or shopping at supermarkets or going vegan aren't truly human. So I don't think that's a very strong objection.
And so, yeah, I want to talk about what that looks like practically, but what got you interested in this? What led you to conceive of fixing suffering in the entire biosphere?
Heavens. Well, I was, shall we say, a troubled adolescent. I was prone to rocking to music with my eyes closed in the dark, just thinking about the nature of reality. In some ways, typical adolescent angst, shall we say. But thinking about the problem of suffering and what could be done about it, I was finding out about the pleasure centers, as they were then known, from the work of Olds and Mills, and how no tolerance is shown by intracranial self-stimulation. And thinking of, well, what about various psychotropic drugs? Could they recalibrate our hedonic treadmill without the idiocy, the imbecility of wireheading? But this, of course, was a good many decades ago. The human genome hadn't been decoded or anything like this. And it was still technically very crazy. The missing piece of the jigsaw for me was Eric Drexler, Engines of Creation. I could see how it would be possible to use genetic engineering to phase out suffering in humans and maybe even higher vertebrates, but the deep oceans and Amazonia and so on, how on earth could one access them? So since then, not merely has there been a genetic revolution, there's also been a revolution in so-called synthetic gene drives, which combined with CRISPR would actually make it quite technically, I wouldn't say straightforward, but technically feasible to reach even the most obscure marine invertebrates. It's not the most morally urgent thing to do now, but yes, if we do ultimately want to phase out suffering throughout the living world, it's going to be, there are the technical engineering challenges and there are the ethical, ideological challenges. But we can only have a serious ethical debate on whether we should get rid of involuntary suffering once people are aware of the fact that, the level of suffering in the biosphere is now an adjustable parameter.
Okay, yeah. So what are the actual, what's the technical kind of roadmap that you envision for doing this? What's involved? Kind of what are the stages? What would this look like playing out over, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of years?
I would favor, I don't think it's going to happen, a World Health Organization-sponsored 100-year plan to defeat the biology of suffering. In practice, I think much more likely are slow and incremental progress. I mean, here are three things that I think, I think we should start ethically as a species by stop systematically harming other sentient beings, i.e. we should shut down factory farms, slaughterhouses, introduce in vitro meat. So that's just negative. On the positive, on a more positive note, I think that there should be universal access for all prospective parents to pre-implantation genetic screening and counselling. I mean, at the moment, as we know, most people, at least unless they have a serious disease, genetic disease that they're worried about passing on to their offspring, have kids and trust God or Mother Nature to produce a happy outcome. Yes, as we know, all too often life on Earth is studied by all manner of tragedies, great and small. Though many people would support the idea of, let's say, genetic screening to weed out alleles for cystic fibrosis, most people would still be very wary of the idea that you can choose benign alleles for something like pain sensitivity or hedonic set point. It's actually easier to, if you're a prospective parent, thing like the SCN9A gene, nonsense mutations prevent any capacity to feel pain. Rare people born with this disorder have to lead cosmical existences, but there are dozens of other alleles of SCN9A, and some are associated with extremely high or low pain sensitivity. And if you're going to have a kid, I'm sure you want the kid to be able to sort of function normally and avoid noxious stimuli. But if you look at today's outliers for pain sensitivity, the kind of person who says, typically male, oh, pain's just a useful signaling mechanism and so on, one can start by making sure that all future kids have, a high tolerance of pain, high pain thresholds. Something like hedonic set points, which I discussed quite a bit in my work, there isn't a single gene that you can tweak and guarantees that you're going to have a temperamentally happy child. But if even let's say two or three genes, something like the COMT gene, or serotonin transporter gene, or another gene involved in noradrenaline, if you pick benign variants, you can massively load the genetic list in favor of your kids being temperamentally happy. This isn't the really ambitious transhumanist stuff I was talking about at the start of the interview of life, sort of plus 70 to plus 100. But if you look at today's hedonic outliers, the kind of the people, and Anders Sandberg is a good transhumanist example. People with very high hedonic set point, they're not manic, they are productive, socially responsible, but you're loading the genetic dice in favor of your kids. And I hope that low mood is recognized as at least as devastating to quality of life as some of the better known genetic disorders. Obviously there are countless pitfalls. Listen, I can probably think of them, but if one is going to have children, bring new life to the world, it's an obligation to minimize gratuitous suffering.
So you kind of have this staged plan where we try to reduce suffering that we bring to other beings through something like reducing factory farming, veganism, maybe something like that, and then genetically engineering ourselves and our children going forward to try to reduce needless suffering and just kind of iterating on those processes.
That's it. It'd be too ambitious doing everything at once, and there is a distinction between pre-implantation genetic screening and true genetic engineering, that the kind of CRISPR genome editing now means that it is possible to create new genes and alleles and allele combinations. I mean, that is full-on genetic engineering. Pre-implantation genetic screening is more modest in one sense. But rather than my laying out kind of some detailed 10-point blueprint now, I mean, it's really just wanting to raise for discussion these issues, because as long as people continue to have in the traditional way, I mean, suffering is going to go on indefinitely, however many social, political, religious, personal kind of reforms.
So, okay, so let's talk about this, because you do want to change the physical world and make it better and remove this suffering. You also want to increase people's just happiness. So you talked about the set point, like how kind of innately happy you are, I guess. Talk about the difference between that and wireheading, and whether we should prefer to do one or the other, why we should avoid something like wireheading.
I mean, something like wireheading, the only people who are attracted to the idea of perpetual stimulation of the reward centers are people who are severely depressed. They used to be called the pleasure centers. There is a complication that it now seems that what is being activated by mesolimbic dopamine stimulation is more anticipated reward. But nonetheless, by electrodes, it would be possible to induce perpetual euphoria. But it's very difficult to see a world like this. There would be selection pressure against wireheads. I mean, people who are perpetually euphoric wouldn't want to have baby wireheads. It would lead, it just doesn't seem sustainable as a model of society. So although it's a useful existence proof as the kind of the lack of tolerance that intracranial self-stimulation shows, I don't think it's the route forward for civilization as a whole. That's one possibility. The other is drugs, by which I don't mean the standard recreational drugs that simply kick the brain's negative feedback mechanisms into gear, but drugs that are more finely tailored and reversible. But, I needn't go into detail as to the countless problems that drug use can bring. And so though it's possible that drugs are going to form part of a strategy for becoming transhuman, I think much, much better will be to just ensuring that our future kids and a few decades' time, possibly you and me, can have a high hedonic set point, because that way one can still be responding normally and adaptively to good and bad stimuli. One's default quality of life is much higher.
What's interesting to me, I've thought a lot about the problems of wireheading, and you point out that there is a selection pressure against it, that essentially evolution would resist this because it would inevitably lead to the end of a particular generation. So I've wondered about that, because, I feel like our brains actually have to deal with that problem already. Like, our brains are so powerful, we could just drug ourselves in essence. And I feel like we have a lot of safeguards in place to keep us from doing that. And so I wonder about that in general. Like, is there a problem with what you're trying to do, like that that maybe you haven't foreseen, but that nature is avoiding? Does that make sense?
I would, well, the possibility of unknown unknowns can never be discounted,
sure, yeah,
and it's worth taking very seriously. But I mean, the obvious thing to do is case studies of today's hedonic outliers. That's people who aren't clinically manic, but a psychiatrist would say hypothalamic. They just have an extremely high hedonic set point. And those set points sounds like spaces. All this means, in fact, is that their average default is much higher. They can have, you know, good hair, good and bad hair days. They can, all the kind of the negative feedback mechanisms are in place. It's just that their default quality of life is much higher. And there are complications in that there is so-called depressive realism. I mean, one can ask why, you know, evolution has played with these dial settings. It seems that non-social animals don't tend to get depressed, and it may well be that low mood is some kind of adaptation to group living. Internalized part of the losing subroutine induces people to keep their head down in the ancestral environment. If you were to take on an alpha male and lose and be expelled from the tribe, that could be lethal. But it doesn't actually technically seem any harder to, in a sense, for nature to program a life of pleasure than pain. I mean, already so-called animal models have been achieved of essentially mice who don't get depressed, and equally brains of mice that are extremely depressive. And the same can in principle be done with humans. Sooner or later, if one talks like this, someone will mention the dreaded E word, i.e. isn't what you're arguing for, eugenics. But at the risk of stating the obvious, the well-being of all sentience was not part of the racial hygiene policy of the Third Reich. So those are profound ethical implications of, rewriting our genetic source code. I don't think this kind of ethical strategy should be automatically shoehorned into the horrors of the 20th century.
There's a thing there that you're kind of getting at, which is that if you're talking about something like raising this genetic set point, you're talking about narrowing the genetic diversity in along certain dimensions, right? There's which are pretty clearly nice dimensions to narrow it. Like having fewer depressed people is seems like a positive, but yeah, there is, you know, that narrowing of genetic diversity seems like a risk factor.
Intuitively, yes. However, a couple of points here. First, in principle, with genetic tweaking and engineering, one can create far more genetic diversity than has been possible in the past, because natural selection can't cross these fitness. So, in principle, one can have more neurodiversity, but just there are some forms of physical neurodiversity one doesn't want. Last time I checked, there were almost 1,000 different alleles of variant alleles for the cystic fibrosis gene, whereas the ideal number would be zero. Likewise, I think that by ensuring all, you know, everyone has this default high quality of life, one can enable them to go on to lead much more diverse and flourishing lives, because one of the characteristics of being essentially temperamentally happy person is one engages in more exploratory behavior, one One finds a broader, more diverse range of stimuli rewarding. It tends to be depressed people who get stuck in a rut. And the second response to this neurodiversity worry is that I gave the example of how in the future we could aim for a civilization of plus 70 to a plus 100, if schematically our hedonic range today is minus 10 to 0 to plus 10. Now, plus 70 to a plus 100 would, in a sense, be a greater hedonic range, and yet it would be generically sublime. Now, intuitively, sometimes people will wonder, well, isn't sort of pain and pleasure very much relative? Surely sinking from a 95 to 75 would be disappointing, but it doesn't seem to be the case. And that just as tragically today there are people who are chronically depressive or pain-ridden, and some of their days are worse than others, but the days that they're terrible aren't. Likewise, it will be possible to essentially have a life entirely animated by gradients of well-being. But the stress on the gradients is important, because one would want I wouldn't want anyone to suffer on my account, but nonetheless I would in some sense selfishly perhaps want dips in well-being if I experienced it would make a mockery of personal relationships if people just sort of went on partying, as it were.
It's really interesting that this suggestion, because it you're saying, okay, we can still get the effects, the benefits of having pleasure and pain just by having kind of gradients of pleasure, so to speak, to a large extent, and just eliminating the pain component. Is that
essentially
and something I saw, you gave the example of sexual pleasure as being this kind of thing we experience on a gradient, we want more, even though there's not, we can avoid the pain part entirely. We can just have this kind of gradient of pleasure.
I'm stressing that because, I mean, I do, even though I'm a crushing prude in practice, I did give the example of two sensitive lovers. Yeah, lovemaking has peaks. Mm-hmm. And troughs, but one wouldn't describe the troughs as unpleasant. That can be generically perturbable throughout. And transpose this rather earthy example to other aspects of life. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be science fiction. One can study today's hedonic outliers.
And so that kind of answers the question of, like, do we need to, do we need to have pain to motivate us, or in these other areas of life, things like that. At least in one example, we don't seem to, right? We seem to be able to function without that. That's a really remarkable idea. Whether it's true or false, if it's true that we can function without pain, well, it's pretty incredible that we have pain.
Essentially, nature doesn't care. This is it. I mean, one looks at silicon robots, and sort of progressively, as they eclipse us in so many cognitive domains, but without the raw feels, and clearly would want to hang on to the good rewarding aspects of life. But if we can offload the bad stuff, either by recalibrating a hedonic treadmill or alternatively loading some functions to smart prostheses, would be more traditional humanist idea, this idea that we can offload stuff to various forms of bodily augmentation. I don't discuss uploading, which is the most extreme form of this, I'm a skeptic. I don't think, as you know, the digital computers will ever be our subjects of experience. But nonetheless, there's no saying that with AI and smart prostheses, one could be massively enhanced. And that is, one route to get rid of the nasty stuff.
Well, okay, so I'm wondering, you know, what you're talking about here, what you're proposing is essentially that humanity takes this role of essentially pacifying the world, right? Taking on itself to eradicate the suffering of the biosphere. And I'm wondering how other vegans have responded to that, right? So you're with a lot of people who want to, you know, practice kind of a personal ethic of not increasing suffering. But how do those people respond when you say, well, let's actually go beyond that and change the predators into non-predators and so forth?
It's a mixture of responses. Some vegans are sympathetic. You know, literal global veganism just wasn't really technically possible to envisage until relatively recently. I mean, most people will just think, well, if we were to tweak, obligate carnivores, predators, there would be a population explosion of herbivores followed by a Malthusian collapse. And therefore one would need kind of cross-species fertility regulation, you know, contraception or something like that. So I think it's fair to say that vegans, vegetarians, and the animal rights community mixed response, because, of course, people are vegan or vegetarian or support animal rights for different reasons. I think many, I should say, more traditional vegans, vegetarians have a rather idyllic view of nature, this idea that the kindest thing humans could do to non-human animals would simply be to leave them alone. And the view of what we're doing in factory farms and slaughterhouses and elsewhere, I can certainly understand this view. But nonetheless, if one does investigate life in a state of nature, essentially, yeah, most sentient beings lead short, unpleasant lives. And it is irrelevant from their perspective whether suffering is inflicted by humans or simply because they starve to death or end up in the jaws of a predator.
Right. Well, and this is one of the kind of ways in which transhumanism in general tends to differ from many people's approach to things. Many people are happy with taking kind of a personal ethic of reducing suffering or doing good in the world or something like that. But when you start to talk about like doing that on a large scale, proactively doing that, people get much less comfortable with that. Do you have a feeling about why that is?
I used to think the problem was ethical, ideological, but I think the biggest challenge is really status quo bias. Because what one can do, this kind of thought experiment, imagine, and it's fanciful, I don't think it's going to happen, that we do encounter an alien civilization that has phased out predation, all the nastiness of Darwinian life, and ask people if they really would want to introduce predators and involuntary suffering and all the horrors of this Darwinian world. And I think most people, if insofar as they accept the thought experiment, would their response is no, of course not. But it's this sense, I think, that people have this appeal to nature, that what is natural is good, and it's deeply rooted. It's highly selective, of course, because people will make the appeal to nature wearing clothes and using their iPhones and surrounded by all manner of gadgetry and home comforts. But many people are unwilling to generalize. Perhaps they'll watch a wildlife documentary and even be indignant that the cameraman didn't intervene to save the baby elephant or something like that. But nonetheless, if you suggest that our long-term goal, and I stress this is long-term goal, not a five-year plan, should be to civilize the biosphere and phase out suffering, then yeah, most people will at best be skeptical. Some will be quite hostile. So, but I think one is in much stronger ground if one explores the implications of someone's existing values and beliefs. You know, whether it's the Christian, what would an all merciful, all compassionate God want us to do? You can, if it's a secular ethicist, an all compassionate, full spectrum super intelligence.
Well, that's kind of interesting because you brought up the you know, like, envision a alien civilization, right? And in essence, what you're doing there is you're recalibrating our set of expectations, which is, I think, as you've kind of indicated, is what a lot of religious imagery does. So the idea of, like, the lion laying down with the lamb is an inconceivable outcome, right? Except that that is a that is part of this religious vision. And so I see a similarity there that that by kind of meditating on these, we can kind of recalibrate our sense of what's possible and what's desirable.
Yes, I think the first time people come across the idea that we might decide to phase out traditional predators and predation, they are shocked and outraged. But when people, you know, if one starts a conversation and people think one is talking about human predators, they sort of reflexively agree. It's only if they then realize, hey, he's talking about non-human predators too. Because in the case of the victims of human predators, the very young, the old, and the vulnerable, we prioritize the victims, but when it comes to the rest of the living world, we tend to do this somersault and romanticize king of the beasts, etc.
Interesting. Yeah. So, well, okay. So you've called this in some places, like, the idea of a welfare state for the biological world, something like that.
It's a welfare. Unfortunately, the term welfare state to an American audience may have negative connotations. But yeah, pan-species welfare state, because both human and non-human animals seem to flourish best when free living, but neither captive nor wild. So it's not a case of turning the whole biosphere into a zoo. But just as, humans, you know, want safe but regulated spaces to be able to go about their lives, I would envisage something similar to for future wildlife parks too. But this, in one sense, this is leaping far ahead. I think our overriding obligation right now is to stop systematically harming non-humans. I mean, this is the idea of, yeah, going on to civilize the biosphere is the last element, shall we say, of the abolitionist project on Earth. But we need to think about these issues now, because something like sort of conservation initiatives, captive breeding programs for tigers and lions and things like that, we do need to have a discussion over values and whether traditional conservation biology should be replaced by compassionate biology.
Well, so that's one thing that I would think of, you know, in this. From your perspective, it seems like you're operating according to an ethics in which the primary moral drive is to eliminate suffering. And if you accepted that, if you embrace that, wouldn't an easy way to do that just be to, say, press a button and blow up the entire biosphere, like just knock it out of existence? If you could do that instantaneously, wouldn't that fulfill this kind of drive.
Well, yeah, when Buddha says, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the relief of suffering. I mean, as far as we know, no wiseacre in the audience said, hey, Buddha, so you destroy the world.
Yeah.
I think any solution to the problem of suffering has to be both technically feasible and sociologically credible too. And for better or worse, most people seem to think that the suffering in the world is a price worth paying for the good stuff. And so rather than getting caught up in strict, you know, this negative utilitarianism, would you destroy the world if there was a button? I think we should work within certain constraints. And just as, yeah, someone decides to give over their life to helping chronic pain patients, you know, a doctor, one constraint, even though this is his primary focus, he doesn't go around bumping his patients off. I think it's extremely wise to uphold the sanctity of life, not necessarily in the literal religious sense, but yeah, enshrine in law, because so many things can go wrong. Humans, as we know, lessons of history, simply can't be trusted. So, yeah, I think there should be constraints. And one needn't, though, yes, certainly Buddhists and negative utilitarians would say our overriding obligation is to minimize suffering. One doesn't need to buy into a Buddhist or utilitarian value system to think it would be a good idea if we phased out involuntary suffering.
Well, what I'm wondering is, so we're kind of envisioning a future in which there is no suffering, but is there a that kind of, in a sense, is moving us to zero, right? Like we're below zero right now in a world of suffering. We move to zero in a world where we don't experience suffering. But what about the is there a bigger vision that we should be entertaining in terms of what we do in the universe or anything like that, or what we become beyond just not being suffering versions of ourselves? Do you have any kind of sense of that?
What I try to avoid, if possible, though sometimes I indulge, is sketching out my vision of paradise. I think one wants to establish the broadest possible consensus if we're to have a good chance of success. And that though I think our overriding ethical obligation is to phase out involuntary suffering, as I see it, that once we have done this, then ratchet up our hedonic range, all kinds of activities that today, I mean, for example, like psychedelic drugs and theogenic drugs. Today, it's very hard responsibly to urge their use because they're extremely unpredictable. People can have bad trips. They don't, in many cases, they're not consistent with losing a family, a job, stuff like that. Whereas once we have phased out the biology of suffering, then it will be, for example, impossible to safely explore psychedelia. I mean, this is something that I would personally find more interesting than let's say star hopping. I think if one's watched a lot of Star Trek, there's this idea that one would be bumped into interesting alien civilizations. But as far as we know, the galaxy is sterile for technical reasons. I suspect this is going to be the case. So it doesn't excite me in the same way as it does some transhumanists and futurists, this idea of colonizing the galaxy. I mean, I suspect we will eventually do so. Mm-hmm. One could get into a philosophical discussion about the nature of value and disvalue, but yeah, it just seems to be an empirical fact that the pain-pleasure axis seems to disclose the world's inbuilt metric of value and disvalue, that if you're in agony, it's sort of built into the nature of the experience, it's bad. And as I said, other things being equal, if one can continue ratcheting up hedonic set points and hedonic range, I think this is good. And so long as one is careful to preserve discrimination, it means that one isn't asking people to buy into your particular values and preferences. Because in many cases, you know, if one looks, you know, across the world, so many of people's values and preferences, they're conflicting. There's no way even post-human superintelligence could reconcile all that. Conflicting, you know, it can be something, well, I was going to say trivial. I would say trivial, you know, wanting your football team to win. Many football supporters would disagree. But whether it's peace in the Middle East or having your football team win or being world chess champion, in a sense, there's no way that everyone can have their preferences satisfied. But there is a technical way for everyone to lead a fulfilled life. If I seem to be focusing exclusively on the biological genetic rather than the social, it's simply because there's so many of the socio-political problems are intractable.
Well, so there are kind of a couple of questions I have about the about this one of which is that kind of another version of the, you know, press a button and blow up the world issue, which is it seems like maybe one of the ways we could reduce the suffering of lambs in the world is just to reduce the population of lions, right? And so we could presumably cause lions to go extinct, and then, you know, there would be no predators, and we could just kind of do that across the board, like cause predators to go extinct without any particular increase of suffering for them. Why wouldn't that be a desirable way to go?
I would be extremely relaxed about this, but nonetheless, if we are to build some kind of agreement and or consensus or facing out involuntary suffering, I think it's best to stress the reprogramming or tweaking option or sort of technical fixes like catnip-laced in vitro meat. In the longer term, just a slight metabolic tweak, because I think many people will think, oh, good heavens, these monsters, they want to kill my tittles or something, and my tittles won't dare to fly. I see members of the cat family in the same way a mouse would see them, you know, this terrifying killer. But most people, if you say a cat or a lion, will have positive associations. And any suggestion that one might somehow want to, and this emotive language is quite often used, exterminate predators or something like that, triggers a very strong response in people. And so to get any kind of consensus, yes, one should try to work with the grain of human nature and data's crow bias and this kind of charismatic fauna. Most people wouldn't be too sorry if the Anopheles mosquito went extinct in the wild, but nonetheless, people like this notion that there are lions out there, even though they'd never go safari on Africa themselves, or they may not even watch wildlife documentaries, but they just, you know, like to think of a world with lions. And well, there can be a world with lions, but there doesn't need to be a world of asphyxiation.
So the thing you brought up earlier, which is interesting, like in terms of how we kind of do genetic engineering and all this kind of stuff, like, you know, one of the biggest fears that people have about this is the idea that, you know, some people who are rich will be able to do this kind of stuff and some people who are poor will not be. And how do you address those kinds of concerns with any of these kinds of proposals?
I think and this point is not original to me, but the cost of any information-based technology trends inexorably to zero. And just as my music collection is just as good as Bill Gates. And when it comes to the price of getting your genome sequenced or pre-implantation genetic screening and counseling, the price is just collapsing. Now, in one sense, there's a risk of sounding complacent here, but essentially the substrates of well-being won't need to be rationed. There's no way that positional goods or status goods can be generated in unlimited abundance, but something like access to good code for oneself and for one's offspring, I don't think price is going to be the determining factor. I mean, something like I mentioned earlier, universal access to pre-implantation genetic screening and counseling for all prospective parents. I mean, it would be extremely cost-effective because it would catch not merely any potential mental disorders, but also many lots of genetic disorders too. So it's cost-effective for first world and third world countries alike, and it needn't be cost-rationed. I mean, today, screening, pre-implantation genetic screening is most commonly practiced not in the first world, but in India and China. Unfortunately, it's most often done for gender selection. Let's say some wonder drug is produced, with a radical anti-aging drug or an extremely safe, long-acting mood brightener. What if it were covered by patent protection? And I tend to think that if a drug is wonderful enough, governments would just decide patent protection be damned. I mean, we've seen this with expensive aid drugs, and I can see this happening with other drugs or gene therapies in future. But potential pitfalls, problems, inequalities. As I said, my optimism, such as it is medium to long term, not short term.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your kind of unusual perspective on consciousness and AI. You said earlier you don't think computers will ever become conscious. So
classical digital computers. It is possible that futuristic quantum computers centuries hence will be subjects to experience. But yeah, I don't think your PC, however fast it's running and how sophisticated the software is, ever going to wake up. No.
So why is that? What's your understanding of consciousness? Because that's pretty rare for a transhumanist, really.
Yes, here we get into quite heavy duty philosophy. But there are two separate questions. There is the so-called hard problem of consciousness and the binding problem, and to have a subjective experience, one needs to solve both of them. And the hard problem: how is it that if one makes the assumption that the basic stuff of the world, the fire in the equations, is non-experiential, which strikes most scientifically educated people as plausible, if this is the case, then how is it that first person experience, consciousness, can occur at all? But even if it is the case, let's say, that brain cells, or even right down at the most fundamental level of the world's quantum fields, are experiential, nonetheless, unless that consciousness is phenomenally bound, all you have is a so-called micro-experiential zombie. The United States, 330-odd million skull-bound minds, however connected they are, however much they communicate, are not a continental subject of experience, if assuming physicalism is true, no strong emergence. Likewise, I might say something similar with a termite colony, but what makes 86 billion odd membrane-bound neurons in your brain different? Because when you're awake dreaming, you're not just 86 billion pixels of experience. You're a unitary subject with both local and global binding. And depending on how you think the mind-brain solves the binding problem, this will in turn shape your conception of whether classical digital computers can be conscious. And though I personally take very seriously the idea that consciousness is fundamental to the natural world, I don't think this means that most systems are subjects of experience. I think classical digital computer is never going to be anything more than a micro-experiential zombie. It's not bound. There's no phenomenal binding. Now, I could go off into quite speculative conjectures about the nature of quantum mind and binding, but I, unless you think any listener will be fascinated there, I'd probably best to refer them to, and I stress they are highly speculative, and I don't, you know, I'm agnostic, but yeah, I'm willing to explore any idea, however weird, if it's testable. So not, as I said, not all transhumanists believe that digital computers are going to wake up or mind uploading or anything like that.
Yeah, so you've kind of broken it down to two problems, one of which is whether there's where experience comes from, essentially. And I think you're getting at this idea that maybe experience is pervasive and fundamental, kind of a what we might call a panpsychism or something like that. But nevertheless, that doesn't mean that, as you said, all these different things in the universe are subjects of experience. Something happens that's unique in the human brain or other brains, perhaps, that allows them to be subjects of experience. So I guess, does that mean, would you say that there are separate subjects of experience or one subject of, I mean, are there multiple minds, or is there just one mind in these kind of different instantiations, or how would you kind of deal with a problem like that?
In the case of humans, one can shut down temporarily one hemisphere followed by the other. There are multiple subjects of experience in that sense. If you take seriously, as I do, a non-classical account of phenomenal binding, the actual lifetime of these kind of neuronal superpositions is incredibly short. It depends how fine-grained one wants to make one's divisions, because in practice most of us assume an enduring metaphysical egos. Economy and society would and personal relationships would collapse without this assumption.
But that assumption is not fundamental in what you're saying. Which is kind of interesting. I mean, most people who make an argument that, you know, digital computers are not going to become conscious, then go to something like a persistent traditional ego, or, you know, kind of a traditional notion of the soul. And you're proposing something different, which is that there is something unique going on in the human brain, but it's this kind of very maybe fleeting experience. Something like that.
Yeah, you know, his homely metaphor that is flawed in many ways. If you watch a movie, persistence of vision means sort of, let's say, 24 frames of a second. Imagine billions or trillions or even 10 to the power 15 frames a second. If your life and mind and world simulation were akin to A movie running at 10 to the 15 or so frames a second, how would your experience differ? Even, I mean, it's a crazy idea, but nonetheless, what's interesting, and I only realized this rather belatedly, is that it's actually experimentally falsifiable. And if, as is quite likely, it's falsified, well, we'll have learned something, because one of my background assumptions is physicalism, this idea that no element of reality is missing from the formalism of our best theory of the world, quantum field theory. But if there are aspects of our conscious life, our bound conscious minds, that have no echo in the formalism of physics, then dualism presumably is true, as David Chalmers has long argued. And perhaps tellingly, the reason, or the main reason, that David Chalmers is a dualist isn't perhaps what one would imagine. The hard problem is traditionally conceived. It's this binding or combination problem, that there are hints of a perfect structural match between our minds and brain, but no true perfect structural match, at least if conventional neuroscanning is correct.
So what would you say that something like consciousness does? What effect is it? Or is it just an epiphenomenon? Like, why does it exist?
A very good question. And as one looks at the seemingly endless range of cognitive domains where digital computers are eclipsing humans, it is tempting to think of consciousness as just epiphenomenal or a spandrel. In one sense, it's irrelevant whether Deep Blue or Watson is conscious. They can outperform us. Mm-hmm. But I think what is extraordinarily adaptive and is only possible because we are conscious is, back to binding again, the ability to perceive in one's world simulation individual perceptual objects populating a unitary, unified world simulation apprehended by a unified self is extraordinarily computationally powerful. And that, I think, is what consciousness is for. Consciousness per se doesn't do anything, but non-psychotically bound consciousness is formidably adaptive. One only needs to look at syndromes in which binding partially breaks down. I stress only the partially, like people with simultaneognosia, who can only see one thing at once, or motion blindness or cerebral akinetopsia, who can't actually experience motion. They just see a car here, then a car 10 meters, another 10 meters, and then it's on top of them. Or people with schizophrenia and a breakdown of the unity of the self. We are not micro-experiential zombies. We can somehow, in real time, generate this real-time simulation of the mind independent world, and that I think is the adaptive significance of consciousness. But although that's, I think, part of the solution, simply because one can say that something is adaptive, one hasn't explained it. I mean, telepathy would be highly genetically adaptive too, but it's not technically possible. Why? So how, if that is the answer, how on earth does a pack of neurons carry it off?
And in your speculative kind of realm, you've suggested that there's something connected with quantum coherence that's happening here, right? Something like that?
Yes. So a number of researchers have considered the possibility, and the reason that they, for the most part, not all of them, the most part have rejected it, is that the lifetime of coherent neuronal superpositions in the CNS is ridiculously short, femtoseconds or so. I mean, if the lifetime of these quantum coherent states, or cat states, as they sometimes are called, were milliseconds, they would be the obvious candidate for a perfect structural match between mind and brain, because you know, kind of conventional neuroscanning sort of probes the brain on a time scale of milliseconds, scores hundreds of milliseconds, and can discern these feature processing, distributed feature processing neurons. But mere synchrony doesn't seem to be enough to generate unity. And if it were the case that coherent superpositions in the CNS lasted a few milliseconds, then yeah, they would be the obvious candidate. But as I said, Max Tegmark's calculations are most commonly cited. Here, if we assume so-called no-collapse quantum mechanics for lifetime of coherent superpositions in the CNS, it's extremely short, femtoseconds or less. But but one person's reductio ad absurdum is another person's falsifiable prediction, and I think that when that molecular matter wave interferometry is sufficiently sensitive to probe at these temporal resolutions, instead of just noise, I think we're going to find the non-classical interference signature of a perfect structural match. I mean, that's my prediction. It's extremely counterintuitive. If you think it's crazy, well, in a sense, good one. Once theories that have weirdly counterintuitive predictions, if a theory simply says predicts the sun will shine tomorrow, it's probably no good.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. But that would be really interesting if we did those kinds of experiments and were able to start mapping out the structure of consciousness and how it works.
This kind of weirdness cost. No one who takes seriously, you know, the ethical imperative to get rid of suffering or thinks that we should be using biotech to phase out suffering need to buy into any of these quirky ideas. Sure, I mean, I won't say they're completely morally irrelevant, because if, for example, you think that classical digital computers are going to become subjects of experience, or at least with the programs or software they execute, then these kind of questions are highly relevant. But my working assumption is that this isn't the case.
Well, thank you very much. These are a lot of, you know, very provocative ideas, a lot of food for thought here, and on all these kind of dimensions. And I think it's at least worth factoring into kind of the larger transhumanist project. I really admire the ambition of it. If nothing else, so.
Well, I would, it's very kind of you to say that, but I would be very, I think it'd be wonderful too, if perhaps you could help introduce the wider Christian community to some of these ideas, because although I know some traditional Christians would be aghast, as you rightly pointed out, there are distinct affinities between shall we say traditional Christian values and this idea of building a compassionate biosphere.
Definitely. That's a pretty remarkable thing, and I think that it's good for us to be working on that kind of scale of dealing with the biosphere and not just the future of, you know, the human species or something like that. And I think that's not given enough emphasis typically. So, yeah. All right. Well, that's some good stuff. So, thanks so much, David. And I'll point people to your website. Anything else that you would like them to look into?
No, I mean, obviously skim brutally. I think our conversation has given a pretty fair idea of where I'm coming from. But yeah, I'm very keen on this idea of building bridges. And though I'm personally an agnostic, secular, scientific rationalist, one doesn't need to be a secular rationalist to think it would be a good idea to use biotech to phase out suffering.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I definitely agree. I think Christians need to do a better job of working with people from disparate perspectives on practical efforts, really.
Well, it's been great chatting, Riker. Thanks. And yeah, do stay in touch and keep me posted.
Okay, I will do. Well, thanks so much. We'll talk later.
Take care. Cheers, Riker. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.